Hello and welcome to the Herbert Smith Freehills Tax Bite podcast special edition on budget 2024. Once again, coming to you late in the evening. I'm here with Professor Graham Cooper. Hi, Graham.
Toby.
And also fellow partners, Nick Heggett and Ryan Leslie. Hey, Nick. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, Tobes.
G'day, Tobes.
Good more enthusiasm. Come on. Okay.
So, thanks, Tobes.
That's best. The budget was released just on 2 hours ago. In summary, rather short as far as tax measures go, but a couple of surprises in there. Graham, your overview of the budget in general?
From a tax person's point of view, Toby, there was not a lot here for businesses to be concerned about. So I guess that's good news. There was a lot of speculation and a lot of drops and deliberate leaks from the government prior to the budget. The leaks with respect to personal income tax and small business measures turned out to be accurate, but the story about big business turned out not to be accurate. There was a lot of speculation about measures to try to ameliorate the harshness, so people say, of the foreign investment changes. And there was a thought circulating that the government would do something in the tax world so that the changes to foreign investment didn't seem quite as discouraging. As it turned out, that speculation really hasn't come to fruition. So I think the story of the budget is small businesses and humans got what they were promised, and big business got a couple of things that were not expected. Some of them are a little bit nasty, but there's also a lot of giveaways in there for businesses who are in the right industries.
Okay, starting off with the big surprise was the proposed changes to the capital gains tax regime for non-residents. Ryan, do you want to take us through that?
As Graham said, instead of softening the bad news of the FERB changes for non-residents, it's doubling down on the bad news with some expansions to the CGT regime for non-residents. There are a couple of different aspects. The main one is described as a clarification and broadening of the class of assets for which Australian CGT will apply for non-residents, to ensure that Australia can tax foreign residents on direct and indirect sales of assets with a close economic connection to Australian land. This issue about what is in and outside of the taxable Australian real property test has been bubbling away for some time now. I think there's been some publicised change in the ATO position through private rulings on, for example, whether interest in wind farm assets are fixtures and therefore real property, or are not fixtures and are therefore not real property and not subject to tax when non-residents sell. There's a case before the federal court currently, YTL Power, where there was an early interlocutory decision where the parties described the issue as being essentially whether the term real property in Division 855 has its technical legal meaning or some other as yet undefined meaning as contended for by the ATO. It seems that perhaps Treasury has seen the ATO's view and considers that their rules should be expanded. There's not a lot of clarity on what that will cover. It may or may not cover the fixture versus chattel or fixed to land issue, which has been addressed by legislation in the stamp duty rules in, I think, all states now, or whether it's dealing with other issues like stapled structures or synthetic interest in land-rich entities. But we'll no doubt have to wait and see.
Yeah, there's some comment about the idea of aligning Australia more closely with OECD standards and international best practice, whatever that may mean. Graham, any thoughts on that or insight from OECD Article 6 commentary?
I think, Toby, we need to define our terms. I'm not sure if the people who wrote the budget are referring to best practice observed in OECD countries or whether they're talking about the text of the OECD model convention and the commentary on it. I suspect if you looked at the practice of OECD countries, you wouldn't find anything you might label best practice. You'd find a pretty heterogeneous collection of approaches. If you were saying, oh, no, what we really mean is what Article 6 tries to capture, I think there'd be, you know, some queries about whether Article 6 is going to get you what they think they want. Because Article 6 basically says a country can tax immovable property. And what we mean by immovable property is whatever your domestic law says is immovable property. And the model basically says you get to decide. So Treasury is telling us we're looking at what other countries do. If we looked at the OECD model, it says, no, you guys do what you want to do. So that's very strange. There are some expansions to that, which tries to make sure that the domestic law is a bit more ambitious. And Article 6.2 says, oh, in all circumstances, we think you should be going after property that is accessory to immovable property, whatever that means. Livestock and equipment used in agriculture and forestry, which may or may not be the equipment used in agriculture and forestry, would be a bit of a stretch. I think the livestock is quite a stretch. And then they talk about usufruct. You can see the European heritage there. Rights.
I beg your pardon, Graham.
Yes, usufruct, Toby. We don't seem to have a lot of those in Anglo law, but the Europeans are very enthusiastic. But basically, they're payments for user rights and easements and those kinds of things. And payments for mineral royalties and similar payments. So there is some attempt in Article 6 to say you should be at least going after this. But basically, Article 6 says, no, the country where the thing is located can decide whether it is real property or not. So I'm not sure that this reference to best practice is anything more than a smokescreen.
And Graham, that does raise an interesting issue, which I think has been debated, at least academically in the past, about the fact that Australia does obviously have a fleet of existing double tax agreements, which bear potentially some resemblance to Article 6, and in other cases, not much resemblance. And across those fleet of treaties, that's our current domestic CGT rules for non-residents probably largely comply, but the further we look to depart from ordinary concepts of real property to include these other things will, I think, raise some tension with some of those treaties, perhaps not all of them.
Yeah, I think that's right, Nick. The amendments in 2000 were done explicitly to wind back Australia's tax claim to match what we could claim under our treaties. And so now we are going to try to walk that back.
That's right. And at least in the mining context, we did have announcements by the government back in 2013 that they would look to pick up things that wouldn't ordinarily be real property in the mining context, a la mining information and goodwill associated with a mining company, if there is such a thing. And they seem to have abandoned the desire to follow that through. It'll be interesting to see whether that gets revived here. The ATO did have some success in cases against disposals of mining companies, although the ATO won those largely on the basis that the taxpayer wasn't able to prove what the value of the relevant assets were, so lost on the burden of proof more so than the ATO winning the technical arguments. And I'm aware of a number of cases moving through the courts at the moment. So it may be that the government's trying to head off any adverse decisions that may come out of those cases.
And Ryan, there were two other minor tweaks to the CGT non-resident withholding regime.
Yeah, that's right, Toby. The first of those is changing the principal asset test from a point in time to a period test. As a refresher, non-residents are subject to Australian CGT on capital gains when they dispose of membership interests in an entity if they have a non-portfolio interest, so 10% or more in the entity. And that's tested by reference to a kind of 12-month holding over a 24-month period. And the entity satisfies the principal asset test, which is essentially by value, more than half of its assets are or are attributable to interests directly or indirectly in Australian property. So that second test, the asset value test, will be moved to apply over a 365-day period, which I suspect probably has some appeal from a high level in terms of adding some integrity to the principal asset test, but it feels like it will be a nightmare from a compliance perspective, especially for a non-resident who's a minority investor. If someone has a 10 or 15% interest, working out how to determine the value of individual assets over 365 days when accounts are prepared at best monthly and usually not audited or subject to valuation testing, I imagine is going to be quite difficult. So it'd be interesting to see how that is actually intended to operate. And the final change is to require non-residents who are disposing of membership interests with a value exceeding $20 million to notify the ATO in advance. I think this is really continuing a trend that we've seen the ATO start to impose via the FIRB process and FIRB conditions, where since tax conditions have been imposed largely as a matter of course, we've moved from a requirement to notify within 60 days after disposal of an interest that was subject to FIRB approval requirements on the way in
to now a requirement to notify in advance, and seemingly a notification now will be imposed as part of our domestic law rather than FIRB approvals. It will capture more circumstances, one suspects.
Yeah, it's a pretty low threshold of 20 million, given approval doesn't kick in until much higher, assuming it's not a national security asset, but very minority stakes in high value startups may suddenly be having to report to the ATO, whereas previously they just would have declared it was not taxable Australian property and given the relevant declaration to the buyer, and that would have been the end of it. Anything further on the CGT judges?
One wonders if the pre-notification is simply a notification, or whether it will be the kind of measure where you can't actually go ahead until the ATO has run their eye over it. At the moment, there's just a discussion that says you'll have to notify them if you're selling stuff worth more than 20 million. But ordinarily, these rules seem to require a response from the ATO to say, okay, you can go ahead. You think of the non-resident CGT withholding stuff and the GST non-resident withholding. So the devil will be in the detail, but query if it's just simply a matter of sending a letter to the ATO, or whether you need to wait until they get back to you before you can dispose of your parcel.
And certainly on small transactions, there can be signing completion on the same day, and negotiation of the deal is usually up until the last minute. So that will be interesting to see how we navigate that in this context. Okay, Nick, incentives.
Yes, thanks, Toby. I mean, just quickly on the last point, we have had some experience recently in the public sphere of the ATO reaching out to someone selling and to remind them of their CGT withholding obligations and to offer to make sure that you do not fall foul of the withholding rules. So I don't know if that's the sort of comfort that the ATO has in mind in relation to this notification requirement. It seemed to be more about comforting the ATO than comforting the taxpayer, but they were certainly looking over our shoulder throughout the process, make sure we did the right thing. In relation to the tax incentives, obviously this is part of Australia looking towards the future, and the two areas highlighted are one in relation to critical minerals, which is obviously a large focus of the government to try and incentivize companies to not only produce critical minerals, but to look to further process and refine them in Australia, something that in relation to some critical minerals is dominated by the Chinese, and therefore looking to diversify away from possible supply constraints in the future. The first one, the production tax incentive, is very much focused at that, and will be offered to people that process and refine those minerals in Australia, and will be focused on giving you, from what we can see, a tax credit for 10% of the relevant processing or refining cost. This will kick in the 27-28 income year and last for 10 years. And so obviously people got to make those decisions today with the comfort that those rules will be in place, but also they obviously don't get that cash until they actually get the production off the ground. So it's not doing anything to help them get off the ground. But to be fair, the government has also suggested a fleet of other measures to help people, including funding of projects and these kinds of things. So it certainly is a large focus. And the other credit is in relation to production of hydrogen, or in particular green hydrogen from renewables projects. And again, that will be in the 27-28 year and will be a $2 per kilogram of green hydrogen produced. So we don't really know much more about these. Will they be refundable? We don't know, but presumably they will be, you would hope, to make it a proper incentive, but we'll wait to see the details.
You'd also hope they'd been designed with Pillar 2 in mind, and to make sure they're not inadvertently tripping up along those lines. How many thoughts?
Oh, I was just, you can't help but remark upon the 27-28 tax year start date. This is well and truly after the next election, and may well be around the time the election after that happens. The shadow treasurer was on the television tonight saying they oppose this. It's a big ticket number. It's one of the biggest spends in the budget. It's about $13 billion. Now, it's over 10 years, but the opposition have said they're going to oppose it. They may not succeed in stopping the legislation from opposition, but they might be encouraged to switch it off if they get to be in government before it has really start to bite. So query if this is really going to excite a lot of people who are in those affected industries.
We'll wait and see on that one. Some good news. The government has announced that the proposed rules to deny certain payments relating to intangibles held in low tax or no tax jurisdictions will not be continuing on the basis that the issues will be addressed through the Pillar 2 global minimum tax, which the Assistant Treasurer also said they would be introducing legislation shortly on those measures. It's a welcome change, but Graham, we were talking just before we started recording about your thoughts on dropping this measure because of Pillar 2, but the interaction with the hybrids rules and why that hasn't also been similarly amended.
When we enacted the anti-hybrid measures in response to the first round of BEPS, Australian Treasury decided they were going to add in a creation of their own device, which they call the integrity rule, which basically denies you a deduction for interest if it's paid to an associate in a jurisdiction with a marginal tax or with a tax rate of less than 10%. So the logic of that measure was no deduction if interest is going to a low tax foreign jurisdiction. The measure that they've just switched off is pretty much the same measure. It is no deduction if you're paying a royalty to a country that's a low tax jurisdiction. So we've just decided that the Pillar 2 measures are adequate to deal with a royalty going to a low tax jurisdiction. The obvious question is, why is Pillar 2 not adequate to deal with interest going to a low tax jurisdiction? We don't appear to have an answer to that, Toby, but it's a glaring omission. And you do wonder why they couldn't tidy up that particular mess at the same time they're tidying up this one.
Yes, the wonders never cease. Of course, with any piece of good news, often there's a corresponding piece of bad news, which in respect to the intangibles, there will be a new penalty, which will apply from 1 July 24 significant global entities found to have mischaracterized or undervalued royalty payments to which rule withholding tax would have otherwise applied. Obviously, in the context of cases such as Pepsi, this is a hot button area and the whole characterization of embedded royalties and how royalty withholding tax should apply is certainly a bit of a black box and mysterious art as to how you go about valuing what the correct royalty was.
I think that'd be particularly interesting in the context of there's the diverted profits tax, which the ATO obviously used to try and collect tax on what it said were disguised or undervalued royalties in the Pepsi case. So it would be interesting to see whether this penalty potentially extends beyond cases involving just royalty withholding tax or only DPT.
The other interesting announcement in relation to anti-avoidance rules was, so this time last year, the government had announced that they were going to amend Part 4A with effect from 1 July 2024 to amend Part 4A to capture schemes which either resulted in lower withholding tax rates applying or achieved an Australian tax benefit but had a dominant purpose of obtaining a foreign tax benefit. So the government hasn't quite got around to actually releasing exposure draft legislation, let alone enacting those measures. So it has pushed out the start date to the date of royal assent. But once enacted, the new rules will apply to transactions, regardless of whether the scheme was entered into before or after that date. Finally, two other very small matters. Small business $20,000 instant asset write-off is extended to 30 June 2025. That's available to entities with an annual turnover below $10 million, and then increased funding for the Tax Avoidance Task Force. There has been increased to $1.2 billion to cover the 2027 and 2028 financial years, with an expectation of raising an additional $2.4 billion in tax.
Graham?
Well, I think both of those measures, they cannot be killed. They're like the phantom. The small business instant asset write-off just gets renewed year after year. Surprise, surprise, it was in this year's budget as well. The funding for the ATO to try to counter tax avoidance, again, that funding just recurs every year and the measure just keeps on, the project just keeps on living. Although, Toby, I'm just eyeballing these numbers and I haven't checked this, so you can tell me I'm out in my computations. But my recollection is the multiples used to be a lot bigger. So when these measures were first started, the multiples were like, we'll give you a dollar, ATO, and we'll expect you to collect three. Now we're back to, we'll give you a dollar and we'll expect you to collect two. So the ATO is getting $1.2 billion and they're expected to raise $2.4 billion. So I think we've got ourselves a productivity crisis in the ATO, that they're not being as productive with that money as they used to be, Toby. But I'll leave that one for others to opine about.
So the collection targets still seem somewhat optimistic in the context of a shrinking tax gap. But again, I'm sure it can be accounted for.
I think that's all we've got for this year's budget special. Any closing comments, Graham?
I think there'll be a couple of sleepers in here for people who are affected. I think the CGT on share sales is going to be an issue. And that will require some careful monitoring by large sections of the corporate community. So that one could be a nuisance and an annoyance. I doubt that there's any money in it, but it will be just a pain to manage. And the rest, I think, is all rats and mice, Toby. So I think we've had a good night.
Probably the last budget before the elections, no doubt. Both parties will be taking an ambitious tax reform platform to the elections. And we may have more things to talk about in next year's budget. But on that note, thank you, Graham.
Thanks, Toby.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks, Toby.
And Nick, unfortunately, had to dash. But thank you for listening. And we'll be back soon.